twice. Okay. Welcome. Today is the 26th of November. This is the third in our lecture, the second on the Jews of England in the medieval times. And okay. So where do we leave off? Actually, just where last time we did a little bit more of the in-depth history of England, but right now this time we'll just go straight from where the Jews. In 1066, William, who became William the First, from Norman, he conquered, he went to attack and he ended up conquering England. He believed that he had a right to the throne because he was cousin when the king died. I don't know if it was Edward the Confessor or Harold, but he was related to the king, and he felt that the throne belonged to him. He raised an army, conquered England, and then he became the. Now some say many when he became conqueror, when he conquered England, he brought with him Jews from France with him. So as early as 1066, but even in his time. There was no, Jews were not permitted to own land, and they had a lot of limitations. Again, they money lending, that's what they were doing in Europe anyway, so that they were very, very much limited. Now, again, this is the years that the years for the throne, or the years where the Jews were, starting with probably William the First, who was known as William the Conqueror. And again, Edward had died and Harold took over, but William didn't like that. So William killed Harold, he conquered, and he became king. So it's really going to go from William all the way to Edward the First. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the ninth king. Nine kings. The ninth one is he's going to expel the Jews. And last week we spoke about William the First, we spoke about William Rufus, Henry, Stephen, and we started to get by Henry the Second. So that's pretty much where we're going to pick up our story with Henry the Second. Just quickly, William the Second, William Rufus, he was the he came after William, and he came with the Doomsday Book. He died 1087. His land, William's lands, were divided. Normally to his eldest son Robert, second son William got England, and here we go, William, Henry, so went from William the First to William the Second. Now Henry didn't like that. Robert got something and William got something, and Henry, who wasn't called the First yet, but Henry got nothing. So that's what all these kings had to do. They had to keep the lid on. They had to keep everybody happy, and if you didn't, there's going to be fights, and people are not going to be happy with one another. So that's exactly what happened. Henry, he went, he somehow had William knocked off, you know. Hunting accident. It happens, you know. So William dies in 1100. So William's brother Henry, he goes and takes over. William is killed. Henry takes over. And then, of course, Henry runs to Westminster Abbey. And he goes ahead and then he attacks Normandy, takes out his older brother, and now England is all back under one conqueror. You have Henry the First is now again the king of England and the king of the Duke of Normandy, or now whatever that the western part of France. So Henry the First is a very big and a very powerful ruler. The kings of England were always much, much more centralized, much stronger than the kings in Europe were, in the mainland Europe. That would bring us again to, so William, Henry kills these two, and now he's got everything. He's okay, now we mentioned also last time Henry had everything. Natural resources, good justice system, strong central government, nobility, abundant of land, hardworking populace, strong military, and efficient tax system. What are they missing?
But did he learn to speak English?
Henry the First, I believe, did.
Okay.
But Richard the Lionhearted didn't speak English.
What did he speak?
French.
England.
Yeah, we'll talk about. Hopefully, we're going to get to Richard soon. But in general, the first language of the nobility was French of the English kings. The population, which were really preceded the Normans, preceded the French, were from the Angles and Saxons, which were German tribes, and they were from the Celts before, and they mainly spoke what later became English. So the population spoke English, the nobility basically spoke French. Okay, but what England still...
What were we missing in the last one? You said we were missing something.
This is what we're missing, a middle class. You're missing a middle class and you need money. So what do you do about that?
So you Jews.
There you go. So you bring in your Jews, and part of the problem is like the I guess this is all min hashamayim, because like why would the church do this to themselves? But they box themselves into a corner in that, you know, they can't lend money on interest. I mean, nothing else in the Torah seemed to bother them, right? Like you could eat tarfis. You know, you could, but I guess it's like Menashe Mayim that in reality, I mean, it was a double-edged sword for the Jews, but it's really what helped the Jews survive all of, you know, medieval Europe, because it was such a necessity for Jews. It was such a necessity for money lending, and especially the kings and the royalty, they all realized this, how indispensable they were, and when they forgot how indispensable they were, and they got rid of their Jews. So either they eventually took a big plunge and, you know, would either order them, force them, or cajole the Jews to come back. But it was huge. So England still needed the middle class. They needed money. Christians could not fulfill this role. I think later on in the 1300s, they found a heter. They found a... Somehow they were able to get around it, you know. But so Henry really promoted Jewish immigration. This is Henry the First already. So Henry the First promoted Jewish migration, and he set out a charter protection of the Jews. This is, we did this last week. This is, yeah.
The church law against lending on interest, did that come from us?
Well, they have the Old Testament. Yeah, so you can't charge a brother new, you know, interest. So they took it from the Old Testament. Just why this and not other things, I'm not exactly sure. But when it came out into Europe, it was huge. Now, how is society supposed to expand? How do you, you know, nobody's going to lend money unless there's interest. So that's where the Jews came to fill that role. Yeah, I think people want to say, when the Reformation happened with Martin Luther, and a lot of the things in the church, once they loosened that hold of the church, so the whole Europe just expanded, just went very, very, was able to expand and able to do so much, because they weren't restricted, you know, by church law in terms of interest and stuff. So, yeah.
If he was a ruler of his mind as that, he'd open up Chabad houses all over.
Who, Henry?
Henry, then he would have had business and Jews would have been tourists.
Well, I mean, after all said and done, I mean, a Jew is still a Jew. Like, you know, you had to be careful where, you know, they were Christians and Jews, you know, were, they you know, if you realize the need for the Jews, then, you know, you're using them for their needs. But still, they're not Christians, they're Jews. And, you know, you can't be too, you know...
Like a reverse Shabbos
coin. You always have... Right. You have... And that's a good example. But you always have that tension, because in terms of the royalty and the church, sometimes they're on the same side, and sometimes they had... they were on the opposite side. You know, and therefore, in terms of how to treat the Jews, sometimes the church was much better in treating the Jews than the royalty. Sometimes the royalty was much better than the church, but there was always that tension. You know, so you couldn't always be so you know, so good to your Jews. You know, in every country, you still had your priests and your bishops, and you still had your church that had to you had to make satisfy. Okay, so again, we did this last time also. Henry's royal charter on the Jews. Jews were permitted to move around the country. They sell goods and property, sell their pledges, tried by their peers, by other Jews. They could swear on a Sefer Torah, special way, Jews' personal oath meant something. And, okay, now this is also was very significant. England was, again, ahead of its time in understanding that Jews belonged to the king. So you were king's property. You touched a Jew, you damaged a Jew, you stole from a Jew, you were damaging or stealing from the king. Now that carried a lot of weight. These kings could kill somebody at a snap of a finger. These were full monarchs, and they did kill people when necessary, but so you were generally afraid of your king. It's not like the president today, where you could scream and say all these terrible things and nothing's going to happen to you. The freedom of anything, freedom of speech or anything, it was really non-existent then. So when you have a good king and a strong king, and you know things are good, that's a very good place for the Jews to be. When the king is unpopular and you're the king's property, then by associative, right? And you're also not going to be popular. King Henry I died, so he did not have a male heir. He had a daughter by the name of Matilda who was married to Geoffrey, and there was now a fight for the throne between Matilda and Stefan. And we mentioned last time, first Matilda had the upper hand, and then Stefan. And eventually Stefan became the next king. So after a few months of maybe about a year of a war between the two, Stefan then took over. Stefan was not as popular as Henry. He also did not have as much control over England. The barons, you know, they sort of took more freedom on their own, and the king was not as strong. That was until till Henry II came about. But one thing that was very significant under Stefan was the first ever recorded blood libel, and it was the first ever recorded was in England. That's, I think we mentioned this afterwards. This was also around the time of the Second Crusade. So whenever there was crusades, it wasn't good for the Jews, because the crusading spirit was to kill the infidel. And I guess when the church said kill the infidel, they meant the Muslims in at that time, Palestine or whatever, the Middle East. And the Crusaders, like they, you know, the local priests, so they were saying, well, why infidels? They're in our backyard. Why are we waiting to go overseas to do it? We could do it here. The first crusade was the worst for the Jews, the worst massacres, but the second one, which is around the 1140s, 1144, and then the next one, another 40 years later, each of them was also not so good for the Jews, and it depends how the kings, the rulers, were able to control their population.
Where did the first crusade take place? Where did it start?
It started, the first crusade took place, it really started from France and Germany. So most of anybody who was west already was sort of safe. As you know, as the crusaders were traveling east to go to the fight, they were destroying, pillaging, killing all the way through. This was last year, different types of, in the first crusade, there was the People's Crusade, and the Ninth Crusade, and it was the People's Crusade that was out of control. They never even made it to the Holy Land. They just killed Jews as they went by, and eventually they were all killed out by the king of, I think, Austria.
Could we relate to that by saying, like, if you look at the way the Muslims attack each other, wipe out each other, ISIS and all these different groups, that's how the Crusaders were? You know, grab them, wipe out a town, you know,
it could be. The Muslims learned how to be vicious and cruel from the Christians. Before the Christians came to the Middle East, the Muslims were cutting edge. they were the, in terms of technology, in terms of being moral and everything, the Jews had it much better under the Muslims. So when the Christians came, they were terrible. They were destructive. They just, you know. So the Muslims learned. Yeah, that's what you have to do when you're dealing with Christians. All right. So let's just that's for a different time. So after Stephen came, this is the first blood libel, William of Norwich, and then since then, hundreds of thousands of Jews have been killed, and hundreds of communities have been exiled, all because of. If there ever was a Christian child that was missing, it was terrible for the Jews, no matter what. Okay, then came after Stephen came Henry II. Now, Henry II was probably the highest, the most, I guess maybe you call it the zenith of all the kings, of all the English kings, at least in the old. He got back order within 5 years. He realized the value of the Jews. And he was a very strong, smart monarch. He had, you know, he knew how to run a country, and he ran a country very well. Under Henry II, this is really pretty much, I don't think we got to this last time. No. So this is pretty much where we got up to. Henry II comes in. He within 5 years, Jews are found everywhere. London, Oxford, Cambridge. They were mostly in London before, but now they're London, Oxford, Cambridge, Norwich, Bungie, okay, all these about 10, 12 different places. However, they're not permitted to bury their dead until 77. In 1177, they permitted Jews to bury their dead in all the cities nearby, whether it's outside the city. Up until 1177, they had to bring their dead bodies to the cemetery in London.
What was the reason for that?
Who knows? Right, that's, you know. Any right you give to a Jew had to be measured and decided. You know, you don't want them to, you know, something that you can't take back. Now, what this did do for the king is the Jews were everywhere. So now the government, if they ever needed to borrow from the Jews, you know, they're all over the place. They had more, you know, like if a certain county needed money. So basically, this is what would happen. What we do today in terms of a government, let's say a government, the state bonds, city municipal bonds, federal bonds, that's really what bonds we do today. The government needs the money right away, so they issue bonds, and then you get the money back. And this is what was happening under King Henry II, in a very common way. Your government needed money. And they would do is they would, the king needed money right away. He'd borrow from the kings, and the kings would write off that when the monies are collected from the counties, it goes, you know, they could, the Jews can collect from the taxes. And it was a great system for the Jews, and the Jews started to become fabulously wealthy. There was a person by the name of Aaron of Lincoln who, that's a picture. So now we're up to here, Henry II. He is actually the grandson of Henry I, and after Stephen, I guess Stephen did not have any, Stephen, I guess, they call Stephen. Stephen did not have any kids, and after Stephen, King Stephen, came Henry II.
Did Stephen marry?
I'm sorry?
Did Stephen marry?
If it does, it doesn't say it here. I don't know if he was married, but it said he was not, he definitely didn't have any children. I guess the next one in line from all this would have been Henry II. Henry II does not appear to, he did not limit any, the Jews at all. The Jews probably during this time were at its height. The Jews were, it was a flourishing community. The Jews, people were moving to England. It was a place where the Jews had a lot of free reign, especially what was going on in Europe. They had a lot more freedoms here. They were a very wealthy community, and it was just, this is probably the zenith. This is the highest where the Jews are going to be now, and after this, it's going to be a slowly it's going to decline. The situation is going to decline for the Jews.
This is about a 50 or 100 year period that the Jews were high, or just about 50?
Well, 1066 is when William the Conqueror So 1066 is about 100 years later. So for 100 years, there's been Jews coming in, but these 30, 40 years is going to be, like, for the Jews, the best of times. We're going to see, I mean, when we start to look at the numbers of, like, tax, that they tax the Jews, it's just amazing. That was just the tax. It means, you know, that means the Jews were doing a lot better than that. Also what happened is, in 1182, Philip Augustus, when he exiled his Jews in 1182, we're going to get back to Philip Augustus, so Jews started coming to England. Again, you know, France and England, you know, it was almost like one, like sister countries. And therefore, a lot of the French Jews came to England at the time. Among them, we know Yehuda Sir Leon of Paris. And we find him in England. And we'll talk about him afterwards. Also, a very, very chashuv visitor came to England was, we know, the Ibn Ezra. We know a lot about him. He was originally in Spain when the Almohads came. They were a fanatical Muslim group that took over from the last Muslim group, and that started under the for the Muslims, for the Jews in the Muslim part of Spain, and the Muslims had the southern part of Spain, Christians had the northern part of Spain, and the Christians were slowly but surely working their way down and conquering. Sometimes the Muslims would conquer back a bit, but slowly but surely, up until 1492, and when they finally conquered the entire Iberian Peninsula, the Muslims were in the southern part, sometimes half, but slowly but surely lower, and the Christians were on top. So when the Muslims, the Jews were doing great under the Muslims until the Almohads came in 1140. And then the Almohads were more fanatical, and many of the Jews left the Muslim part, went to the Christian part. Eventually the Almohads, like, softened a bit, and they realized it wasn't in their best interest. But even still, from that time on, the Jews were more found, from 1140 on, they were more found more in the Christian part. Ibn Ezra, he goes all over. He goes to North Africa, Egypt, Israel, Italy, southern France, and in 1158 we find him in London. Back and in 1161 he went back to back to France. Narbonne is France, but he went back to England. Maybe not. I don't know. But he was in France, in England, towards the end of his life. And by the way, if anybody wants to know, Ibn Ezra was an astronomer. And there's a place in the southern central section of the moon. There's some crater that's called the Ibn Ezra crater.
Wow.
So, named after the Ibn Ezra.
Yichus.
Yes, Yichus. That's me. That's my crater. So that's among other things. I mean, that's not what we know him for. There's a comment. He basically, we know him for his Perush on Chumash. Any, you open up any Makoros Gedolos, Chumash and the Ibn Ezra is there. He was a poet of note. He didn't have luck in terms of money. That's why he was running around the world, probably trying to find his fortune wherever he went. I'm not sure if this was said about him or later, in the 1700s, but it said that he had no luck in business, that if he went into the candle business, it wouldn't get dark anymore. You know, it wouldn't. If he went into the coffin business, nobody would die. You know, that's so. I don't know if it was said about him or one who says the bar mitzvah drushes all come from the. His name will come to me. Anyway. So he was right, but he made his way to England. We have him recorded in England. Okay, just what was Henry II? What did he have? His kingdom was huge. It's huge. Not only did he have England, which is this part, he also had, again, a lot of these came through marriage, you know. So if he got it from his mother's side and from his father's side and from his wife and from him, so he ended up with England, and he also had the west. part of, what is this? Is this Ireland?
That's Ireland.
This is Ireland. He had he got into Wales a little bit, all the way up. He didn't have Scotland, but he had all the way up to here. And then this is France. This is the entire western part of France he had. Not just Normandy. This is Normandy over here. But he also had Aquitaine from his wife, from his, I forgot whether it was his mother or his wife, but so he now, this is a massive amount of land that he had. So by 1172, okay, this is more, this is in France, his what he had, okay. Okay, Henry II had a bunch of kids. And this is an example where they all wanted a piece of the pie. They all wanted a big piece of the pie. And like, so this is where they actually had revolt against the father. So it's like crazy, you know, each of the kids raised an army and started to fight against the father. They all thought that Henry was going to give everything to his son John, which was like one of his younger sons. So his son Henry and Richard, which ended up becoming Richard the Lionhearted, and there's the third one, Geoffrey, I think it was, and so they all started a protest, a revolt, and they all got armies and they started to fight Richard, and they started to fight Henry II in France. That's his France holdings, along with, now you could imagine, King Louis, and King Philip. I'm not sure which one this Louis this is. It's probably one of the first or the second.
All of this is played out in a play and then a movie called The Lion in Winter.
Okay. I am not familiar with The Lion in Winter.
What's it called? The Lion
Lion in Winter.
The Lion in Winter. So this is a... There were two revolts. But the first revolt, I think, was in 1173, and in fact, Henry won. This is King Philip. So King Philip in France, it was in his best interest to get out Henry, so he helped his kids fight against the father. The kings of France and the kings of England at this time, they were sort of related. They saw themselves as like, you know, sister country, so to speak. You know, only later did they, you know, really go to war with one another. And when they did, it was about 100 years, like 100 years war. If it were, you know, okay. So, like, here's Henry. Yeah, Henry's wife was Eleanor of Aquitaine. So that's how he got Aquitaine. So this is Henry II. Here are his kids. So he had William, Henry, Richard, Geoffrey, and John. So Richard, Geoffrey, and Henry, these three all made a rebellion against Henry II, the father. John was originally given, I think he was given Western Scotland, not Scotland, Western Ireland. So he was, you know, but they thought, for whatever reason, that Henry II, he was going to give everything to John. So they didn't like that, so they all rebelled. This is a little bit. So they also, the Counts of Flanders and I can't say Boulogne. I don't know how to say it in French. Boulogne. They helped. They were helping Richard and Geoffrey and Henry III. And they all went. They attacked this way. And the Count of Blois and Louis VII. I'm sorry. That's which Louis was. And then from Breton forces. And this is all the area that Henry II had to fight, and he won. He beat them back in 1173. I think in this battle, Geoffrey dies. He gets killed, and the other two, they surrender to the father. The father doesn't just lets them go. It's hard to understand. Like, you know, two of your sons rebelled against you. Yes, a tati. You know, that's a father. That's what he does. But he let them go. Then again, oh, sorry, so Geoffrey didn't die in this one, but Henry and Geoffrey also, again in 1183, so a number of years later, they revolted again with Richard the Lionhearted. This time, Henry was not as fortunate. He was he had a bleeding ulcer, and they chased him to a Chinon, I don't know how to say it, that was the place, and he ended up, that's where he died. I think Richard the Lionhearted then became, decisively by Philip and Richard, suffering from a bleeding ulcer, Henry retreated to Chinon, and where he died. So Richard now becomes the next King of England. Before, just one last thing about Henry II. Just you see how this Henry II made a treaty with Frederick Barbarossa of the Emperor of Germany. So they decided to make a pact. They made a treaty. Things are nice. And then Frederick Barbarossa said to Henry, there happened to have been some Jews that had escaped to England from Germany. Do you mind returning them? So Henry II said, yeah, sure, no problem. So he sent the Jews back, but he kept their money. You know, just so everybody gained on that one. At least, you know, Henry and Frederick gained on that one, keeping 5,000 marks. That's mark is a lot of money. In 1186, this is pretty much about a year before Henry died in that second revolt, he was planning on going on the crusade, the third crusade. He wouldn't end up doing it. It would be his son, Richard the Lionhearted, would end up leading the crusade along with King Philip. So King Henry wanted to collect. Now, wars cost money, so he had to get money. Kings always needed money. And now you want to go on a war with soldiers thousands of miles away, so you need a lot of money. So he decided to add a tax, a crusader's tax, on the people of England. Now this is what he wanted. He said for the general population, he's gonna make everybody pay a 10%. I'm guessing it's 10% of what they owned, a 10% tax, maybe of what they were making or what they owned. But for the Jews, he wanted a 0.25%. Now keep in mind, I don't know if the Jews were more than 1% or maybe 5%, they for sure weren't 10% of the country of England. But he was going to ask for 25% of Jewish chattel. In other words, whatever the Jews owned, it sounds like 25% of that. And the regular populace, 10%. He was hoping to raise 70,000 pounds from the non-Jews and 60,000 pounds from the Jews. That's a quarter of the Jews. Okay, it's more money from the Jews, but there was so few Jews in relations to the entire country. So the Jews must have been the amount of wealth the Jews must have, that 25% of their property was almost as much as 10% of the of England in general. Okay, you're right. It didn't have to be paid at once. I mean, taking so much money out of the economy at that time is not good. But it was, it was, you know, billed over the next few years. During this time, there was a person by the name of Aaron of Lincoln. Aaron of Lincoln also died about 1186, just about the end of King Henry's reign. He was believed to be the richest man in England, even richer than the king, probably Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, they say, is also richer than today's queen, right, they say, from all her books. But Aaron of Lincoln was richer, they say, was the king. And it's just a little bit about Aaron. So he's first known as 1166, is the first time he's mentioned in the pipe roll. And he had agents that filled all over England. He even gave money to build abbeys and monasteries. So the churches lent money from him in a big way. And among the built were the Abbey of St. Albans, Lincoln Minster, Peterborough Cathedral, and no fewer than 9 Cistercian abbeys. And they were all between 1140 and 1152. And they were in debt to no less than 6,400 marks. I mean, this is when, you know, you picture of what these are. This is what Lincoln Minster is. This is what the Abbey of St. Albans, and this is the Peterborough Cathedral. So all of these were the bank that they borrowed on this was all came from Aaron of Lincoln. I mean, I guess the different shaila is how could you? You know, are you allowed to lend money for the purpose of building a church? And I don't know halachically how that was, but the Maisa, that's what he did. To show you just what he's financing here. These are just three of his many things.
Do you think that did they have any yard site?
Yeah, yard site, like you know, dedicated to
Karen,
you know, donated, right? You know, you know, the kiddush in the back. You know, it's just yeah. The in Lincoln, they have a house which dates back to the time of when Aaron of Lincoln lived. Some say this may have been his house. And when they built houses, the Jews built houses, they built it like fortresses. This is built very strong with stone because they were always afraid, you know, if the mob would come, they'd be able to stay in the house. I don't know, did we mention last time when there was... if not, we'll see over here. Okay, this is a house maybe where he lives. He got into corn armor futures. He was also into futures, corn, armor houses. He maintained agents in 17 of the 25 counties. I mean, this is like, England had 25 counties. 17 of them, he had representatives, full-time representatives. When he died in 1186, he was the richest one. So I guess the United States learned from Henry II something called an estate tax. They didn't learn fully from Henry II. We just make a tax. It's a big tax, right? How much is an estate tax? Well, like 30-40%?
It could be 45%.
45%? So Henry decided he had 100% inheritance tax. So when Lincoln died, again, the king felt, it's all my money anyway, right? It's all, you know, it was, again... If the kings were smart, they have to leave enough money in for him to be making more money. As long as the Jews were making more money, it was good for the king. So you had to balance that. But when Aaron of Lincoln died, this was, I guess, too good to be true for Henry, and he took all his money. That's it. He decided that was it. He took everything that Aaron held, and he took. So he had the physical money that he had. And all the debts that were owed to Lincoln, that were owed to Aaron, all became the debts of the king. Now, at that point, he's from a king, you know, so at that point, he couldn't charge interest anymore. But from that point on, you know, the debts itself now belong to him. It's all his. So what he did is the first thing he did is he needed cash. Again, it's 1186. He's in the middle of a war against Richard and King Philip, you know, there's a war going on, so when he needs to get the cash, he needs a lot of cash to help his war. So what does he do? He takes all his cash, puts it on a boat, and sends it to France. Right, very smart. The only thing is, what happened is, the boat just, I guess, Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, knows when to, the boat sinks basically, when it was going from Shorehorn to Dieppe, I don't know how to say it, but somewhere here in the English Channel, the boat with all of Aaron of Lincoln's fortune sunk. So he didn't gain anything from there. However, he was owed still like 15,000 marks, and he ended up getting a special exchequer called the Aaron's Exchequer, where it was just a separate division trying to collect all of Aaron's debts. By 1201, which is about 15 years later, they gave up and they collected about half the debts, 7,500 marks. So that was okay, and that was Aaron. That's what was happening during his time. Do I have some more money? Okay. Again, we mentioned also during this time Jewish immigration from France. And Philip Augustus in 1181 ordered the Jews arrested and thrown out of the country following April 82nd expulsion. So in 1181, Philip didn't get it then. I guess he needed money very quickly. He just stole all the money from the Jews. And in 1182, he threw him out of the country. gave them an extra 3 months to try to sell their property. Where'd the Jews go? So after not being successful of getting people to stay in the country, many of them found their way to England. So that's, again, the 1180s, think people are moving into England. Good terms. The Jews entered churches freely. For example, if they needed something, you know, you wanted a mashkin. You know, I'm lending you the money. What are you giving me that I can collect from? So often they'd give them things that are in the church, you know, church vessels and different items. So they would come into churches to, you know, to make the loans, to collect loans. They also went into churches in times of danger. If it was a mob and they needed a quick place to go, so they went into churches as well. They would also, all their documents, the documents of debt, where'd they keep them? They kept them in the churches until the massacre at York, and they had a different system. They lived in opulent houses, and at the end of Henry's reign, again that coincided with the Third Crusade, so things the Jews were falling out of favor with the non-Jews. They weren't being very, you know, they were getting jealous of them. A lot of the people owed Jews money, and you put it all together, and it's they weren't happy with the Jews. Just as this is a taxes on the Jews in 1 year, I guess under Henry II, amounted to £3,000, which is over 1/7 of the entire royal income for 1 year. Keeping in mind, very few Jews in the country, like just fabulously wealthy. Fabulously wealthy, just not going.
This is in France.
In England.
Or in England.
This is England, right. In 1 year, they paid a seventh. What's the GDP this year? Well, 1/7 is what it's 1.5% of the. No, it's more than that.
It's about 14%.
Right? It's about 14%. So let's say in America, what's the GDP like? I don't even know anymore. 3 billion? It's like 17% of the Jews today. If that would be what they contribute, that's really what it would be. Okay, comes Richard the Lionhearted. So we mentioned Henry II. He fell to Richard Lionhearted. He was defeated. He died in France, and Richard the Lionhearted took over. Richard the Lionhearted came back. He was, again, the Duke of Normandy, Aquitaine, Gascony, Cyprus, Poitiers, Angoumois, Nantes, overlord of Brittany, and all at the same time. So also Richard the Lionhearted had a lot of land. He didn't spend too much time in England. Once he was king, of the 10-11 years he was king, he only spent about 6 months in England total. But again, he was known as Richard Lionhearted because he was a great military leader and warrior, which he was. And in his crusading in Israel, when he crusaded against, he was up against Saladin, right? The great Saladin. Saladin was known even among the Christians as a great leader, just a very fine person. And we all know Saladin had a very good doctor. You know who Saladin's doctor was?
Rambam
was Saladin's doctor. See, you start to put things into perspective where things were, and, you know, at the same time the Rambam wrote his thing, you had the Bali Tosfos working in Europe. So, but he held out. There was a time when Saladin had him, but he kept his forces in check. He was never able to get to Yerushalayim, but he was able to maintain on the coast, and he had to come back because he didn't trust Philip. He thought that Philip, he said, "I'm not feeling well, I'm going home." And then after a while, he thought that Philip was trying to take over England, so he cut the crusade short, and then he went home. Richard the Lionhearted came home. On the way back, he was caught, captured, thrown in jail, and there's a Marcus Lehmann book, How He Got Out, some Bali Tosfos, some count. got the money. I don't know if that's true, but he was eventually freed. He was third of five sons of Henry II, known as Richard the Lionhearted. Okay, that's, I guess, a picture. Here we are, Richard the Lionhearted, and Geoffrey, okay. We're going to see he didn't have any children, and when he dies, John is going to take over. Little bit 16, he had his own army at 16, commander of the Third Crusade against Saladin. He never made it to Yerushalayim. This is where he went. So three kings. That was the difference between the Third Crusade and the first two. The second one never made it to Israel, Eretz Israel. They just never made it. Or the first, that was, they got most of Eretz Israel, and the third was, that was the kings. It became a king's crusade as opposed to a religious movement. So it was Richard the Lionhearted from England, and Philip Augustus from France, and Frederick Barbarossa came overland to, and that's the way they met, I think. And the other two really didn't stay too long, and there was never unity among them. That was, we did this a few years ago, right? We did this last year, the Third Crusade. Okay, he spent 6 months in England, and he regarded England, this is just a way for me to get money. That was his, like, business venture, you know, his people have, like, a rental, right, that brings in money. So England was his, like, rental. That's the way he viewed England. But now, what did happen, and this was very significant, and this led to a lot of problems. He had a coronation in Westminster Abbey, like all the kings before him. And it was important for him. It was a very important coronation. He had to, you know, people had to know he was the king. And this is early on. And he had a big coronation in Westminster Abbey. He did not invite women or Jews. But there were a number of Jews that were outside the door, and they had like a present for the king. You know, they meant it, L'shem Shemayim, and here they are, submitting themselves with a nice gift for the king. And I guess at some point there was a momentary commotion, and a few of the Jews snuck in. I mean, you just see how something can just get out of hand. So they snuck in. When they got in, I guess they got some far in. Now, first of all, it's a church. I mean, they have really no business going into the church. But okay, let's put that aside. I guess somehow English Jewry, that didn't stop them too much. We see them building churches. They're going into churches.
Maybe not during Zman Tefillah or something. Maybe,
okay, yeah, whatever it was. You know, whatever it was. I mean, it's again, halachically, I don't know what the they went. And they went to sneak in. I guess they wanted to see the grandeur of it, or they wanted to give the present. When they got closer inside, so there was somebody who was in charge who realized that there were Jews there, and they started beating those Jews for trying to break in. When they started beating the Jews, so the people outside, I guess, you know, not everybody can get in, so they started beating their Jews, and many of them were killed. There was one Jew, I forgot his name, also a very rich Jew, that they were ready to kill him, and he said, I'll convert, don't kill. And after the commotion, the archbishop, you know, allowed him to go back. They didn't have to, he was forced, and he didn't have to live his life as a Jew. When that happened, and now you had the Jewish emissary, these Jews were being killed, beaten in Westminster Abbey, so the rumor spread that Richard the Lionhearted said, you can kill Jews. And now all Jews of London were in big, big danger. And they were coming after them all over the place trying to kill them. Now, when Richard the Lionhearted found out about it, I mean, he was furious. Because, again, he understood that Jews, he needed money more, like just like every other king. And he knew, you know, that having Jews, you know, safe Jews making money is good for him. So, what ended up happening is, now, you know, Richard is on his way for the crusade. I mean, he was just coronated, and now he's on his way to go overseas. So he quickly, during that day, so most of the Jews were able to escape to the Tower of London, which we'll see. And that night he put out a ruling. He said, writ demanding that Jews be left alone. It's not true. I never said that the Jews should be killed. Now, the Jews were being killed because a lot of them, they owed money to Jews. This is their way of not having to pay back. The people were being killed. They went to a place, to the Tower of London. And among the people that were killed was somebody called Jacob of Orleans. This is a picture of the Tower of London, which is today. This is, I guess, where the Jews had run to for safety. So they weren't all killed. They were able to run. They'd run there. Richard sent out a decree, leave the Jews alone. And while he was in England, they left the Jews alone. And just when he left, then a different problem. We'll see what happened. By the way, Yaakov of Orleans in Yevamos on Daf Dalid, Tosis, Dechsiv, the Hiksha Harav Yaakov de Orleans. So he was one of the Bali Tosfos. He's quoted in Tosfos. Here it is. Hiksha Rav Yaakov de Orleans, Yevamos, Daf Dalit. He's quoted a number of times. This is one time. So of the people killed that day was one of the greatest of the, you know, big one of the Bali Tosfos. Okay. A few months later, so Richard the Lionhearted had left, and the Crusades, you know, you had knights and people gathering to go off to fight the Muslims. So in a place of York, this is the infamous massacre at York. 1190, 150 Jews were attacked in York. Massacred, and they took refuge. They ran to take refuge in the Royal Castle, which is Clifford Tower, and they ended up, the people, they surrounded them, and it was just a matter of time, so they ended up killing each other. You know, one day, each one killed each other. There was a few survivors, and the next day, when they realized a few survivors, they said, okay, if you come out, and I don't know if they said if you want to convert or not, but if you come out, we won't bother you, we won't kill you, and sure enough, they came out and they killed them. So that was a total massacre. This is Clifford Cat Tower. This is where they took refuge in this area. But everybody was massacred there. Now,
this is not when they had the fire at York or something, they burned them, that was something else?
It could be. Oh. It could be that, the, you know, there was, you know, they who did this? So these were the barons, these were people that were the nobility that were heavily indebted to the Jews. When they were finished at York, so then they ran to the church. And they ran up to whoever it is, the priest, whoever it is, and they said, we want now to give over the documents of what the Jews owed us. After they killed the Jews, they went to the church, and they gave them the chest. The priest wouldn't want to die. He's a shomachinam. You don't have to be killed over... You know, that's it. You know, list the mezuzah, and, you know,
even a shomer sacher,
list the mezuzah. Go ahead, take what you want. So they took the documents... And over the fire on the thing over there, they burnt all the documents there. Now, you could imagine when Richard the Lionhearted heard all about this, he was furious. Furious. What most of the nobles and knights, whoever did this, so many of them were part of the crusade. So, you know, they finished, you know, they got the Zerizis Makdimen, we did our thing, and then they went over to England. You know, mitzvah gerus mitzvah. They start here. And that, so many of them were on their way. The nobles that were involved, they ran away. They ran north to Scotland. That's it. They ran out of town, and for a few years until they were able to come back. This is what you're talking about. They burned several houses. There was a riot in York too. We have a. I remember hearing that there's like a cherem. You're not allowed to live or spend overnight in York. I remember hearing something like this. But it may not be so, because in the Shilas and Chuvos, it brings down that there were people from York or the community in York. It seems that after this incident, people at some point moved back to York. In 1186, at some point they moved back. So the silo was captured, Jews left alive were murdered. They stole the records from the nearby cathedral and burned them. Now, we have in Kinnis... Shalu Srufa. In Tisha B'Av, we have an entire poem dedicated to the massacre of York. Okay, now, when that happened, so you got to realize that Richard loses out. Again, this is all money that's really owed to the king. You killed my Jews, and you took my money. And there's no more documents. So because of this, Richard came up with a new policy that any time there is a document to be written, it has to be duplicated. One stays there, and one goes to the royal treasury. So this something like this could never happen again, which in reality is probably good for the Jews. It was good and bad. It had, you know, on the one hand, it was good because it wouldn't pay to kill the Jews, you know, and burn the documents, because there's a second document that's, you know, in Washington, you know, in London, that's under the king itself. So it wouldn't pay to kill them just for that. You're going to have to pay it anyway, and then you get the king upset. But yet, on the other hand, they know exactly everything what the Jews owe and how much every deal was. It's, you know, sometimes, you know, you could deal in cash. You know, you get a, you know, now you don't have to write everything in the books. But now, everything had to be in the books, and I think the Jews had to actually swear on this. They had to have some sort of a shvua that they... right, so this that this is all that they had, that everything is true. Okay, catalog of all Jewish holdings, rich and successful. Okay, now there was an exchequer of the Jews. Now you had something special, the Jews, you know, part of the government that dealt with now in Jewish finances, because up until now they didn't keep records of the Jews. The Jews' records were all over, just. The king would tax them, and they would send to the Jews. But now the king had a record of all this, and now they had to have a government office watching over all of those things. Okay, the question is should we should probably I guess that we should end here after Richard the Lionhearted, and we have from 1210 to 12 the next 90 years. 80 years or so, because they left in 1292. So the next 82 years, it's going to be all downhill from here. The Jews, you know, are going to hold out during Richard Lionhearted. During John, it's going to get worse. During Henry, Henry III, it's even worse. And Edward, that's it, they're out. All right, so maybe we'll finish up England next week, and maybe we'll get into the... Maharami Rotenberg. I want to go back to Maharami Rotenberg and his student, the Rush, and then we go into Spain and we try to put it all together. All right, any questions? Or
this is before the British controlled the seas, and this is earlier, right? That was later in history?
That was like 1500s.
Yes. Well, the British always had to have a strong... Right, but this is really before... right. It's a good question. The British did have a strong navy, but you're right. In terms of the British Armada, I'm sorry, the British Navy against the Spanish Armada, that happened much. That's going to happen later. That's going to happen after Columbus discovers the New World and Spain goes into it in a big way, and then other countries realize, well, we don't have to go to the New World, we can go to Africa, we can go to... So that's going to be much later. All right. Questions? All right.
In astronomy classes, they learn about that. That's what you think, or around the country?
I've never been to an astronomy class.
Thank you.
You know, I've heard more about astrology than astronomy, you know. You know, you do the mazalos, sir.
Yeah.